money, but it's a bigger picture. But he did say to me, and he's sickly, but he was very happy and excited to know that we're finally going to get justice, finally going to get justice for Henrietta Lacks, for his mother.
The Thermo Fisher settlement could now lead other companies to examine how they're profiting from biological specimens and ask how ethically their samples were collected. In 2010, the publication of journalist Rebecca Skloot's book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, pushed many institutions to address their role in exploiting Lacks, including the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, which is the largest public funder of biomedical research. The NIH opened a dialogue with the Lacks family, which led to a HeLa cell working group to improve transparency by reviewing proposals for projects that use the full DNA sequence of cells. Still with us, Dorothy Roberts, director of the University of Pennsylvania Program on Race, Science, and Society, who's followed this case closely. In 2014, she gave the Henrietta Lacks Memorial Lecture, interestingly, at the Johns Hopkins Institute for Clinical and Translational Research. Professor Roberts, talk about the significance. We don't know how much the settlement is, but the significance of the contribution Henrietta Lacks made, perhaps unknowingly, to global science and medicine and the number of people she helped.
Yes, I like the way her granddaughter said there's a bigger picture to this. This settlement is long overdue compensation to the descendants of Henrietta Lacks, not only for taking her cells without her consent and knowledge, but also compensation for the really immeasurable medical advances her cells have given humanity, and that multiple biotech companies, including the one that settled with the Lacks family, have reaped in profits from those advances. And so to me, this settlement represents a broader message that the Lacks family's fight for decades for racial justice in science and medicine sends to us. It's a form of reparations, I think, for all of us for the way in which biomedical science has used Black people's bodies for centuries in experimentation without consent, without benefit, direct benefit to the people who contributed to the science. Although it's benefited millions and millions of people, maybe everyone in this nation, certainly, and then globally, has benefited in some way from these remarkable cells that multiply endlessly and can be used in multiple ways and have been used by science for the development of the polio vaccine, the COVID vaccine, HPV vaccine. The cells went up in space to see what the effect of weightlessness would be on them. They've contributed to in vitro fertilization. I could go on and on. They are absolutely irreplaceable and remarkable and immeasurable in what they've contributed. And I want to emphasize, though, what the Lacks family's fight for compensation and for justice means more broadly, because I think it's important to understand that what happened to Henrietta Lacks didn't just happen to her. It's part of a long history of experimentation and exploitation of Black people in biomedical research. And that has been grounded on a racist myth of Black biological difference. This is a myth that human beings are naturally divided into biologically distinct races, and that was invented by Western scientists in order to justify enslaving Black people and experimenting on Black people's bodies. And Henrietta Lacks' story itself refutes this ideology, which has underlied so much of biomedical research in the United States. This idea that Black bodies are different innately and, in fact, inferior, and therefore need to be enslaved or need to be regulated and can be used for experimentation because they're so innately distinct. But yet her cells have been used to benefit all of humanity. So her story itself refutes this really toxic, damaging, horrible underlying racist ideology that has fueled much of science in the United States and, you know, in particular, biomedical research. And then there's other implications as well, not just for acquiring consent. I mean, the Lex family got a settlement earlier with the National Institutes of Health, an agreement that they could have more control over how Henrietta Lacks's cells were used. And so it raises these questions about how scientists today continue to take parts of people's bodies, including their cells, without informed consent. And also it raises issues about access to healthcare and the benefits of scientific research, where so often scientists go into Black communities to use Black patients, incarcerated people, children in foster care for their studies, without engaging the communities in the design of the research or giving back to the people who live there. And all of this is part of the fight that the Lex family has been waging for justice. And I just think it's a wonderful way that they have given all of us, through Henrietta Lacks's cells, but also through their fight for justice, to examine these deep issues of racism, this deep legacy of racism in biomedical research and science more broadly.
Professor Roberts, I wanted to end by asking you about this shocking story out of Detroit, Michigan, involving a woman named Portia Woodruff. She was 8 months pregnant when police arrested her at her door for robbery and carjacking. Six officers showed up at her home as she was getting her daughters ready for school. She was held for 11 hours, released on a $100,000 bond. She says she started having contractions in jail, had to be taken to the hospital after release due to dehydration. A month later, prosecutors dropped the case because the Detroit police had made the arrest based on a faulty facial recognition match. According to the ACLU, Woodruff is at least the sixth person to report being falsely accused of a crime as a result of facial recognition technology, all six people Black. Portia Woodruff is now suing the city of Detroit. The New York Times had a major story on this, saying Portia Woodruff thought the police who showed up at her door to arrest her for carjacking were joking. She's the first woman known to be wrongfully accused as a result of facial recognition technology. She was 32 years old. They asked her to step outside because she was under arrest for robbery and carjacking. She looked at them. She pointed to her stomach. She was 8 months pregnant. She said, "Are you kidding?" Professor Roberts, can you talk about the significance of this and what she went through in that last month of pregnancy?
This story captures so much of what we've been talking about, so much about the devaluation of Black people's lives, Black women's lives, and the way in which these deep myths about Black biological difference and inferiority and the need for regulation and surveillance get embedded into technologies. They're embedded in medical technologies. They're embedded in policing technologies. They're embedded in artificial intelligence algorithms and predictive analytics. And so just, you know, one piece of this is the fact that the six cases we know of false arrests based on false AI facial recognition are involving Black people. Now, that's not an accident. That's because racism gets embedded into the technologies. It's in the databases, because the databases are based on police arrests already, or police action, which we know is racially biased or targeted at Black people. And so the data itself gets embedded with racism. The way in which algorithms are created have assumptions that are racist. With the facial recognition, the way in which the recognition technology is created is more likely to target Black faces. All of this has been shown in research. So there's this idea that AI is going to be more objective than the biased decision-making of judges and police and prosecutors. But if it embeds prior biased decisions, it's going to produce these oppressive outcomes. And also, if it's being used by police departments that are racist, they're going to be used in racist ways. And that gets me to the next point, which is the way in which she was treated. She, as a obviously 8-month pregnant woman, was treated cruelly and inhumanely by these police officers, which reflects the way in which police interact with Black communities in general, but also the devaluation of Black women's childbearing. Again, back to this point we started out with, the devaluation of the autonomy, the worth, the humanity of Black women. And a key aspect of that, in fact, a key aspect of the subjugation of Black people in general, has been the devaluation of Black childbearing, the idea that Black women pass down negative, depraved, antisocial traits to their children. Almost sometimes it's stated in biological terms. And that devaluation of Black women, especially in terms of their childbearing, is part of the basis for reproductive servitude, which we were talking about earlier, but also part of the reason why Black women are 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes, maternal mortality, than white women in America. So this one incident reveals this deeply entangled way in which carceral systems in America rely on this myth of biological race and innate inferiority of Black people, which is so deeply embedded that many people just take it for granted.
Professor Roberts, we're going to continue this discussion with our next guest, and we thank you much for being with us. Professor Dorothy Roberts is director of the University of Pennsylvania Program on Race, Science, and Society, author of a number of books, including Torn Apart, How the Child Welfare System Destroys Black Families and How Abolition Can Build a Safer World. Next up, we'll speak with the pioneering legal scholar Kimberly Crenshaw, author of the new book, Say Her Name, Black Women's Stories of Police Violence and Public Silence. Stay with us. Don't you say the things that you said to me yesterday. I know you say that I was doing the thing. I'm going down, that's the way it seems. Shouldn't be the way I can stray. Nobody's holding you back from me. Cause I know how you used to do. When you're saying everything to me times two. Destiny's Child. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We spend the rest of the hour with acclaimed scholar, activist Kimberly Crenshaw. She has a new book out honoring the stories of 177 Black women and girls killed by police between 1975 and last year, who then had their lives erased from memory when their deaths were not covered or misrepresented by the media or were excluded from textbooks. She focused in detail on 9 stories. In her recent LA Times op-ed headlined Black Women Are the Unseen Victims of Police Brutality, Why Aren't We Talking About It?, she notes Black women and girls are more likely than any other group of women to be killed by the police. And, quote, the confluence of factors that converge to make Black women and girls the most vulnerable of all women to state violence also conspire to erase their loss of life both in individual cases and as a group. Professor Kimberly Crenshaw is executive director of the African American Policy Forum, professor of law at UCLA and Columbia University, and author of the new book Say Her Name, Black Women's Stories of Police Violence and Public Silence. Professor Crenshaw, welcome back to Democracy Now! So sadly, your book is more relevant today than ever. Talk about why you wrote it and tell us some of the stories of these women that we should know.
Well, Amy, it's such a pleasure to be back and a special honor to be on with my sister-in-law, Dorothy Roberts, who effectively laid out exactly what the conditions are that contribute to Black women's vulnerability to state violence and the erasure of that vulnerability. We call it the loss of the loss. We call it the marginalization of Black women because their stories about violence and their stories about experiencing anti-Black racism just have not been at the center of how we imagine police violence, how we imagine assault on Black bodies. And yet it is at the core of so many dimensions of anti-Black racism. So we've heard about the Henrietta Lacks story and the exploitation of ourselves. We also heard about the exploitation of Black women's productive labor. Black women were the source of American wealth. We were. It's through our bodies that the slave population came into existence, which is the predicate for American a superpower status. And yet we are the last ones to be talked about. We are the last ones to be elevated. We are the last ones to be defended and marched on behalf of when we are killed, when we are falsely accused, when we die disproportionately in childbirth, and when our productive labor benefits the entire country. So Say Her Name is the one thing, the imperative that we can do something about. We can't give these women back to their families, but we can make sure that they are not lost to history, and we can make sure that the circumstances under which Black women suffer are part of our consciousness about what in the society needs to be addressed in order to really achieve a fully inclusive democracy.
So if you can talk about some of the women, and you talk about the erasure at so many levels, the story of their lives at all, the stories of knowing about them after they've lost their lives at the hands of police, share that storytelling that you say is so important.
Well, one of the things that we wanted to do with telling the stories is both broaden the circumstances so people understand that some Black women are killed not because they were engaged in any kind of lawlessness, but because their family called for help. So Tanisha Anderson was killed just a few days before Tamir Rice was by the Cleveland Police Department. Why? Because she was having a mental health episode. Her family called 911 thinking they were going to get help. Instead, they got armed officers who came and body slammed her and trying to force her into a confined space and then knelt on her George Floyd style while holding a gun on the family, preventing them from coming to her assistance and aid. Michelle Cousseau also killed within seconds of police arriving on a mental health pickup order. This was 5 days after Mike Brown. So these are all of the ways, some of the ways that Black people lose their lives when they have to encounter police, police coming not trained to deal with the situation, police having stereotypes about Black people, not just Black men, Black people. The person who killed Michelle Cousseau said that his life was in danger from this 5'2" woman because of the look in her eye. So what we're looking at is stereotypes about Black women in which they're never seen as damsels in distress. They're just as likely to be seen as threats as their male counterparts, which is why, although Black women are less than 10% of women population, they account for more than one fifth of people who have been killed, women who have been killed by the police. So these are the stories that we need to have in order to see the full expanse of vulnerability. Only when you have the full story can you actually demand the kind of transformations that are necessary to protect people against this particular risk.
Professor Crenshaw, you are now in Martha's Vineyard, where you've just completed a session on critical race theory. You coined this term. Can you talk about it? And of course, it's the subject, it is the target, I should say, for the second in running for the Republican nomination for president after Donald Trump, the Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. You have traveled through Florida talking about this issue. Talk about how critical race theory relates to this kind of erasure that we're seeing here and how you're trying to fight against it.
Well, critical race theory has been weaponized by the far right folks like Christopher Rufo as a container for all of the anxieties, all of the discomfort, all of the retrenchment, the reaction to the anti-racist demonstrations, to what happened after George Floyd. It's a convenient way of capturing that anxiety. It just so happens that, though, critical race theory, it really is something. It's the study of how racial inequality is reproduced, is embedded in our institutions, in our structures, more broadly across society. So the goal of the African American Policy Forum's Critical Race Theory Summer School for the past 4 years is to frame critical race theory in ways that people can recognize it. So when people give their children a talk, for example, the talk is not about the birds and the bees. It's what Black parents must tell their children for them to increase the odds that they will survive an encounter with police. It's the wisdom, it's the knowledge, it's the way that we've had to encounter a world that is not colorblind. Intersectionality also tells us that we've got to give that talk not just to our sons, but to our daughters. That's what Say Her Name is all about. So in the Vineyard this year, we began Critical Race Theory Summer School with two live panels. They can be found on YouTube. The point is to be able to say that the attack on Black knowledge is an attack on Black freedom, but not just Black freedom. It is an attack on our multiracial democracy. That's what January 6th was all about. That's what this upcoming prosecution is all about. This is why the stories that we tell about our lives are essential to this entire multiracial democracy.
Explain how it links directly to January 6th. Of course, we're speaking to you just after President Trump was indicted yet again, this time around trying to basically foment a coup d'etat, overturn the 2020 election.
Well, let's remember one of the most striking images of January 6th was the image of the Confederate flag marching through the Capitol. It had never happened before. And that wasn't just happenstance. If you look at the actual rationale for the claim that the election was stolen, where do they focus their complaint? It's on largely Black, brown populated cities. Atlanta, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, right? Detroit. The argument is that these votes were illegitimate votes. These poll workers were illegitimate poll workers. This is a deep undercurrent in American society that has always felt that the participation of non-white people, and in particularly Black people, was somehow contradictory, somehow not consistent with the idea of who this democracy is supposed to be for and about. Our Supreme Court basically said that African Americans can never be citizens because of their enslavability. What was done to us is a feature of who we are. So it's not an accident that this was the argument that Trump was able to dog whistle. It might not even be a dog whistle. And fortunately, at least as far as the allegations against him are concerned, we are using or seeing the flashback using laws that were developed to address the ways in which conspiracies to rob us of our citizenship and right to vote still are on the books and still can be used to correct the situation.
So let me ask you further about the Republican presidential contender, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's doubled down on the Florida Board of Education's new rules that require educators to teach students that enslaved Black people, quote, develop skills which in some instances could be applied for their personal benefit. Yep, last month, Governor DeSantis defended the curriculum.
I think that they're probably going to show some of the folks that eventually parlayed, being a blacksmith into doing things later in life. But the reality is all of that is rooted in whatever is factual. They listed everything out. And if you have any questions about it, just ask the Department of Education. You can talk about those folks. But, I mean, these were scholars who put that together. It was not anything that was done politically.
The NAACP has called Florida's new curriculum a, quote, sanitized and dishonest telling of the history of slavery in America. This comes as Ron Peared, one of DeSantis' appointees to Oversight Board of Disney's Special Tax District, is drawing attention for reportedly teaching a 2021 seminar in which he said, quote, whites were also slaves in America, and cited discredited research to argue there was the Irish slave trade. Meanwhile, CBS reports two of the nation's largest organizations that cater to Black professionals say they're moving their annual conventions out of Florida because the governor and state lawmakers have become increasingly insensitive to people of color. The fraternity Alpha Phi Alpha said that their convention was scheduled to take place in Orlando, but the organization is now looking elsewhere because of, quote, Governor DeSantis's harmful racist and insensitive policies against the Black community. If you can respond to all of this.
Well, we've been trying to respond to it for the last 3 years, Amy. But the attack on critical race theory, the anti-woke attack on anti-racism, it was always going here. This is what it is all about, the effort to both sides slavery, the effort to basically say, look, at least slavery gave African skills. There was some benefit to it. This is an old ideology, and the very fact that people don't recognize it underscores how much ignorance there currently is about our own history. The idea that Black people were benefited, that somehow they would have been unmoored to any kind of productive labor had it not been for enslavement. This was the rationale for enslavement. This was the rationale for the Civil War. These are the ideas that the Daughters of the Confederacy tried to hardwire into our education system. So when there's a pushback against that and a broadening of our understanding of how enslavement was rationalized, how enslavement was based on the forced reproduction of Black women. All of these facts that have been marginalized are now framed by the anti-woke cabal as indoctrination. They are counter-indoctrination. This is the true indoctrination. And finally, people are able to see it for what it's worth.
And finally, Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, the news of the death of the Harvard Law professor, the civil rights activist, Charles Ogletree, at the age of 70 this past weekend. Can you talk about his significance?
Well, you know, I have a very special relationship with Professor Ogletree. I was part of Anita Hill's legal team and just was so overwhelmed and moved by his willingness to defend her and to understand that even though she was a witness, she was going to be treated as a defendant. This is what we understood from the beginning about Black women's ability to testify, to tell the truth about their experiences. They are not seen, we are not seen as credible across the country, across all groups. His loss is unimaginable. And at the same time, we have to remember that he was a warrior for justice.
We're going to have to leave it there. Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, author of Say Her Name, Black Women's Stories of Police Violence and Public Silence.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
Hey, hey, this is Thurston. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby. Yeah, keep listening to it.